Hello, you're listening to Micronews, the podcast where Laura and I talk about all the times microbiology has been in the news this month.
So I've got a nice little story to start. Bacteriophages are viruses that prey on bacteria. They use the bacteria's replicating software to replicate themselves. In order to do this, they have to be fairly small. However, researchers have found new viral strains that are comparatively huge. Researchers found 351 different strains of these large phages, all of which had genomes at least four times the size of the average viral genome. They actually found the largest bacteriophage ever discovered. Its genome was 735,000 base pairs long, nearly 15 times the size of the average phage, and longer even than the genomes of many bacteria.
Do you think that the these ones with the giant genomes are more dangerous for the bacteria? Like, I feel like if you got infected with a giant phage and it was using your cell software and energy to replicate itself, it would be more dangerous the bigger the genome?
Usually what happens is they just die anyway. So I think that it doesn't really matter how big they are, but actually, interestingly, they actually thought it might be more dangerous for humans, because when they go in and use the replication software, they'll often take part of the cell's genome into themselves. And so if they have a very long genome, you know, the 735,000 base pairs, there's a chance that they could take a disease-carrying part of the genome and pass that on to another cell.
Oh, I see. This month, my first story is going to be on invasive ants that have been found to have seasonal viruses. Researchers have been investigating the virome of an invasive ant species. Argentine ants are one of the world's most successful invasive species and have invaded 6,000 kilometres of the Mediterranean coast. It's important to understand what threats Argentine ants may pose to wildlife, especially as they have already been found to carry Kashmir bee virus, which is a contributing factor towards declining bee populations. Research published in the Journal of General Virology this month looked at the viral ecology of Argentine ants. The research focused on the different species of virus seen in the ant queens and workers. The queens were found to contain more species of virus than the males, implying that they're stronger and able to withstand infection with more viruses. One interesting finding from the research was the seasonality of the virus infection in these ants. Some viruses were only seen during the summer months and would disappear when the weather became colder.
So why do the researchers think that is?
That's a good question. Usually viruses like influenza, for example, behave in the opposite way and spread more easily when it's cold and wet. But the researchers think that the ants may come into contact with more viruses during the summer because they're more active and collect more food when the weather's warm. They could even be contracting these diseases from other insects that they eat as prey.
When the Chernobyl nuclear power plant exploded in 1986, the area surrounding the plant was evacuated and remains abandoned. In 1991, 5 years after the explosion, scientists found a species of fungi growing in the contaminated areas surrounding the now-destroyed reactor. The fungi species was Cryptococcus neoformans. This fungi can cause a serious infection known as cryptococcosis. For regular listeners of the podcast, you may remember me talking to Liz Ballou about it last year. Now, this doesn't sound particularly special, except recently, researchers have discovered the fungus actually feeds on radiation. The fungus contains a huge amount of melanin, the pigment found in humans that makes your hair, skin, and eyes appear darker. This high amount of melanin allows the fungus to absorb the radiation and convert it into chemical energy, similar to how plants use the sun's energy in photosynthesis. What's even more exciting about this research is that it has the potential to be used to protect astronauts in space. The radiation from the sun in space is much more harmful, and NASA are looking into extracting the melanin from the fungi as a cost-effective way of producing a space-approved sunscreen.
A major breakthrough in the understanding of how the parasite that causes malaria reproduces at such a rapid rate was in the news this month. Malaria is caused by a parasitic unicellular organism called Plasmodium, and is spread from person to person by mosquitoes. When inside the mosquito, these parasitic cells reproduce at an incredible rate. The research, conducted by a team at the University of Nottingham, examined the mechanisms that enable Plasmodium to reproduce and develop within both mosquitoes and people. They found a very unusual type of cell division, showing that the malaria parasite has evolved ways to ensure its survival by way of cell division. In particular, they were looking at a molecule called condensin, which is a large protein complex that plays a role in the division and reproduction of cells. What the researchers found in this condensin was that there were two subunits called SMC2 and SMC4. These subunits help maintain the structure of plasmodium chromosomes when they are inside other cells. According to the researchers, plasmodium has adapted to not only survive, but continue to reproduce and grow in different hosts. That makes it more difficult to treat, because the parasite is extremely adaptable and could just adapt to avoid treatment in the future.
Now, we all know what antibiotics are, the fact that they kill bacteria, and the growing issue of antibiotic resistance. But what you may not know is actually how they kill the bacteria. Antibiotics like penicillin kill the bacteria by preventing them building their cell walls. A bacterial cell wall surrounds them, giving them shape and strength, and without it, they can't survive. However, in a new study published in Nature, led by Professor Jerry Wright, researchers have found a new group of antibiotics that fight bacteria in a unique way. This new group of antibiotics come from a known family of antibiotics called glycopeptides. They're produced by soil-dwelling bacteria. These new antibiotics block the function of the cell wall rather than stopping the building of it.
So which function is it that they block?
So for bacteria to grow, they need to divide and multiply. And part of this process, they actually break down the cell wall, so they split and then build a new one. The new antibiotics actually stop this process and block the breakdown of the cell wall, so the bacteria is just kind of trapped in limbo.
Oh, I see. And then it can't reproduce anyway, so it's not going to do much.
Exactly. So it can't reproduce.
And how did they find this new antibiotic?
So obviously with the growing issue of antibiotic resistance, scientists are constantly looking for ways to tackle the problem. This particular research group looked at the genetics of known glycopeptides, and then they looked for those who lacked resistance mechanisms known to science. And if they found one that they hadn't seen before, they thought that this might be a new antibiotic that has a different way to kill bacteria.
So it's kind of like looking where they have no answers.
Yes.
In an effort to conserve coral reefs, which are increasingly at risk due to climate change, scientists have been investigating the role of the symbiotic algal communities that live within corals. Dinoflagellates are a type of algae that live inside of coral as part of a mutually beneficial relationship. These dinoflagellates photosynthesize and produce energy from the sun. They then share this energy with the coral, allowing it to grow. Coral bleaching occurs when corals expel their dinoflagellate partners in response to extreme stress. Coral bleaching has become increasingly common as ocean temperatures have increased. Some corals survive bleaching, but many do not, so it's important to understand why some coral do and don't react to the same environmental pressures. So, this research looked at how corals with different algal communities might respond to climate change, seeing how they tolerate increased water temperature, increased acidity, and exposure to bacterial pests. By looking at the whole community of algae living within the corals, the researchers were able to identify why some were more tolerant to environmental stresses than others. They saw that corals with communities of similar dinoflagellates were more likely to survive than those with a more varied algal makeup. They also noticed that in the corals that performed better, the algal communities did not change much before or after they were exposed to the change in environment, whereas those that did not perform as well had lost certain parts of their algal community. The researchers suggest that the corals that can tolerate stresses more are working well together with their algal communities, both under good conditions and stressful conditions. In the worst performers, the diversity of patterns instead suggests that some corals aren't as good at controlling their microbiome, and under stress, their dinoflagellate teams can go haywire.
So you said that some corals, is that individuals or some coral species?
Individuals.
Within the species?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So it depends on what the algae and the communities within the corals are made up of. They said it was a bit like if you looked at a football team, you could have one really, really amazing player, but if you had a weak overall team, then the team would probably lose against a really good team of players that work well together who may not be individually super great.
Makes sense. That's really cool.
So they're hoping to use this to help protect corals from climate change in the future by maybe feeding or kind of inoculating the water around reefs with a bunch of similar algae that can kind of colonize corals together. And finally, as we promised in last month's episode, an update on the ongoing outbreak of the novel human coronavirus that originated in Wuhan, China. On the date of January's Micronews episode, the World Health Organization had just declared the outbreak a public health emergency of international concern, and two cases of infection in the UK were confirmed by Chris Whitty, the Chief Medical Officer for the UK. So, since then, what has been happening? Since February 1st, there have been an additional 7 cases of infection here in the UK. The UK government declared an imminent threat. During the first 10 days of February, the global death toll from the virus surged to 910, with fatalities surpassing the SARS virus. A number of UK citizens were evacuated from Wuhan and spent 2 weeks in quarantine, with 8 confirmed cases of the virus in the UK. Incidentally, none of these were the people that were evacuated from Wuhan. Another major story which has been covered in the news revolves around a cruise ship named the Diamond Princess that was quarantined near Yokohama in Japan after suspected cases were reported on board. By February 10th, 135 cases were confirmed on the ship, meaning the Diamond Princess has the most cases outside of China. Globally, the number of cases stood at 40,547 with 910 deaths.
So the big news on the 11th was that the World Health Organization finally named the virus, calling it COVID-19. Up to this point, people were naming it coronavirus or novel coronavirus, which is slightly problematic, as many people didn't know that there have already been coronavirus outbreaks, such as SARS, so it could have led to misinformation. Disease outbreaks can have huge knock-on effects. For example, during the outbreak, many large events have had to cancel or have had large exhibitors pull out. Events such as the Mobile World Congress, Global Marketing Summit, and the RSA Cybersecurity Conference all were cancelled or had exhibitors pull out. The ongoing Diamond Princess story developed throughout the month. The number of cases was steadily increasing, reaching 621 confirmed cases on the 19th, with 2 elderly patients passing away on the 20th. Throughout this, many countries were making efforts to evacuate their citizens stuck on the ship. Throughout February, the cases were also increasing. At the time of recording, on the 20th, there are 75,700 cases. 74,576 of those are in mainland China, with 2,128 deaths. However, it's not all bad, as the number of patients recovering is also increasing, with approximately 16,300 recoveries. As well, all but one of the cases in the UK has been discharged.
And a final update on the ongoing outbreak from the past week. Today, the day this episode goes live, is the 28th of February. Since last weekend, the virus has spread more rapidly outside of China, and a number of countries are struggling to contain its spread, including South Korea, Iran, and Italy. Yesterday, on the 27th, 3 more cases were confirmed in the UK, bringing the total number of cases up to 18. And this morning, another case was confirmed in Wales. We will continue to discuss the COVID-19 outbreak in next month's episode. Thanks for listening. As always, if you want to read more about any of the stories featured in the episode, we'll leave links to the stories in the podcast description.
Don't forget to like and subscribe on your podcast provider. And if you find any stories you think we'd find interesting, please do get in touch on Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.